I'm going to talk about airline crew pairing optimization. And this is kind of the bread and butter of what I do. So the first, say, 10 to 15 slides, they'll be kind of on the soft side. So in other words, I'll tell you a little bit more about what airline crew pairing is, what is the underlying problem, what are the underlying business processes, and so forth. And then the last half an hour or so, I'll go into more details on crew pairing optimization. So towards the end, the focus will be on optimization and not so much on crew pairing. So I'm currently at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Urbana-Champaign is about a two-hour drive just straight south from Chicago. So it's actually not that far from here. All right. So first I'll introduce you with the problem. So what really is crew pairing optimization? What really is crew pairing or the crew pairing problem? So here I list the standard and the most important business processes of an airline. Right? And I'm not going to go through all of them because many of them are actually irrelevant for this talk. So if you think this is being long-term, so the higher you up on the slide, the more long-term you are. Long-term, I mean from the day of operations. The further down you are, it's more kind of short-term, more closer to the day of operations. And a day of operations clearly here means the departure time and date of the flight. So pretty much, pricing and yield management, or in other words, yield management is present pretty much throughout the planning process. Then you have, fleet capacity planning, for example, which is the so-called the fleet assignment problem. Maintenance planning, which is how do you plan for the maintenance of your aircraft. And then profitability evaluation, in other words, once you assign your equipment types or fleet to your flights, what is the underlying profit, right? And after you solve the fleeting problem and the maintenance routing problem, comes crew scheduling or crew staff assignment. That's how it's called on this slide here. So as you can see, it's one of the main problems that the airlines face. All right. So what is, from the airline's perspective, right, the cost, the main cost from an airline's perspective is the fuel cost. So the fuel cost dominates all of the airline costs. And this was the case also in the past, not just now with higher crew costs. With higher fuel costs. Okay, today this is even more the case that the fuel cost dominates. Okay, but what is important here is that the second most dominant cost for pretty much any airline is the crew cost. And the crew cost typically consists of two components. The first component is the cost of cockpit crews, and this is the one that actually contributes a lot towards the cost. And the second component are the cost of flight attendants. And the point here is that the cockpit crews are, they get much higher salary, so that's the dominant part of the crew cost. Right? So the flight attendants, for example, if you talk to the airlines and so forth, and also if you browse the research literature, there is very little focus on scheduling flight attendants. There's much more focus on scheduling cockpit crews just because of the implications. If you create savings with respect to cockpit crews, the implications are much more pronounced to the airline. All right? So crew costs now, typically it's expressed as dollars. Right? So this is, you come up with a crew schedule, and then, the pilots then are paid with respect to dollars or any sort of, I wrote here dollars, but essentially any monetary unit. And typically they're actually expressed in terms of minutes. So the value of a crew schedule is this number minutes, right? And it essentially means that there is a, you can convert minutes to dollars, right? Or in other words, you can think about it as crew members being paid per minute, which is usually the case, right? So this is typically, so the first scenario, which is you want to minimize the number of dollars that you pay to your crew members, this is very typical of a U.S. carrier. On the other hand, In Europe, for example, it's much more typical to simply minimize the number of crews, and this essentially implies that every crew pretty much gets a fixed cost, right? So it doesn't matter how you schedule a crew, you're going to pay the same amount of money, right? So that's why you simply minimize the number of crew members that you use, right? So the two objectives are, you know, a slightly different objectives from like, the optimization standpoint. So what are the typical crew processes? What you have to understand is, you know, if we go back to this picture here, to this figure, there is the capacity planning step over here. In capacity planning, you start with a set of flights, which are all of the flights, right? So let's say, American Airlines, for example, has 2,000 flights. So this is what comes as the input to capacity planning. Then you solve the capacity planning problem, or what is also known as the fleet assignment problem. And after that problem, every single flight gets its own fleet, all right? So let's say flight A, so the top flight, Boeing 737 is assigned to that flight. Second flight, for example, Super 80 is assigned to the second flight, and so forth. All right, so after capacity planning, every single flight gets its own equipment type or fleet, all right? And that is then fed, or that is then the input to the crew pairing problem. Right? And it is the input in the following sense. You all probably know that a pilot, a particular pilot, is trained to fly only a particular equipment type. So for example, if you take all of the 737s, right, Boeing 737s, you know, a pilot that is trained to fly 737s cannot fly, say, Airbus 320, right? Or same pilot cannot fly, say, even other Boeing family, so 747, for example, all right? So that's why, after the capacity planning, all of the flights are decomposed with respect to the equipment type. And then for every single equipment type or fleet, a separate crew pairing problem is solved, all right? Because you see, the point here is that there's no interaction between, say, flights that are assigned to 737 and flights that are assigned to 747. Right, so that's what is to remember here. That's what I'm trying to convey here, is that there is a separate problem for each crew-compatible fleet family. So crew-compatible fleet family is 737, for example. All right, 737, for example, has subfleets, all right, which is based on the seat configuration, for example. All right, so this is the point I'm trying to make here. So if the airline has, say, six fleet families or equipment types, then you end up with six separate crew pairing problems, or crew scheduling problems, I should say, right? And the six of them are completely independent of each other, right? So you have, you know, if we try to lay this down on a, you know, time basis, on a timeline, right? You have typical, you know, timeline, say, planning type problems. So on the one hand, you have tactical planning, which happens typically, you know, several months before the actual departure day of the flight, all right, or of the flight, or I should say, of the schedule, all right. And so this happens several months, and then as you move more and more towards the day of the departure, which is this one, which is represented by this yellow line over here, you transition more to the kind of execution side, which means, you know, you make only small changes to the schedule, to the crew schedule, right? And then as the actual departure time comes, you know, you still can do, for example, recovery and so forth, which is, you know, what happens if a disruption actually occurs. So in this talk, I will focus mostly on tactical planning, and I will not mention too much, or actually I will not mention at all the execution side of modeling and solution methodology. Now, in terms of the models, the models are, say, quite different. In terms of the underlying optimization, you can say that it's, you know, quite similar to each other. So, but the focus here is going to be on tactical planning and not so much on execution. So here's how, all right, so from now on, we're going to have one and only one picture. We're going to have one equipment type, Boeing 737, together with all of the flights that are assigned to this particular fleet. Right, 737. Right, so let's say suppose that we are talking about, say, 400 flights, right? So after solving the capacity planning problem, we end up with 400 flights assigned to 737, and now we'll focus only on those 400 flights. We're going to completely neglect the other flights because they don't interfere with our 747 fleet. And the typical, in order to come up with a final crew schedule, the process is typically broken in two major parts. In the first part, we find generic crew itineraries, right? And by generic, I mean we don't really specify which individual crew member is going to fly that particular crew itinerary, right? So we're going to find very generic crew itineraries, and then in the second phase, we're going to assign individual crew members to every single crew itinerary that is found in the first stage. Right? So these are very typical airline crew processes. And the reason why we don't do them simultaneously is because there is tractability issue, or in other words, the optimization still cannot handle that large problem. Right? So that's one reason why they are separated, into two different stages. And the underlying models are actually quite different. Right? So this model over here, which I'll show you, is different from the model that relates to individual crew assignments. So at the end of the first process, the output are so-called crew itineraries, or what is more known as what is better known as crew pairings. Right? So a crew pairing is pretty much a crew itinerary. So from now on, I will be using mostly the term pairing and not the itinerary. And I have, if you still wonder sort of what is a pairing, I'll have a slide a little bit later that actually shows you what is a true pairing. Right? On the other hand, after you obtain crew pairings, you need to make the individual crew assignments, and there you have two different approaches. One approach is so-called rostering, and the other one is so-called preferential bidding systems, or PBSs. Right? So they differ in a way the union contract is pretty much structured. Okay? So in rostering, what you do is you have a pool of, say, I don't know, let's say 60 crew members. They all have different seniority levels. And you try to assign these pairings from your first stage in such a way, you try to assign those pairings in such a way that you satisfy most of the, say, desirements of the crew members. Right? So let's say one crew member likes to be at home Friday, Saturday, for example, and that's, you say, crew member one, right? Crew member two likes to be, likes to have a day off on Wednesday. Okay, so likes to have a day off, say, Wednesday and Sunday. Okay, and you can come up with all sorts of this individual type criteria, and then you come up with one kind of, let's say, big model that is trying to maximize the number of these, priorities that every individual crew member requires. Right, so that's rostering. On the other hand, you have preferential bidding, which is and this is much more common in the U.S., which is you take kind of the most senior crew member and you try to make him happy. Right? So you come up with a 1 month of work tasks for him. Right? Then you take the second crew member on the list, on this priority list, and you try to do the same for the second one. Right, so you strictly kind of follow the seniority list. Right, so these are the two. I'm not going to talk too much about rostering and preferential bidding, but you'll see when I go into optimization, it's kind of the optimization tools that I will present. They can be used in both of these problems here. You have to tweak the model pretty much and do a little bit of tweaks to the underlying optimization. All right. So the focus now, from now on, the focus is going to be on crew pairing optimization. Or in other words, how do you find crew itineraries? And we're going to forget about individual crew members. Right? So what is the input to the crew pairing optimization? Well, I already mentioned one. It's a set of lights, right? Again, set of lights assigned to one single equipment type. So that's one set of inputs. Another set of inputs are regulation rules. So these are rules that are imposed by, for example, in the US, by the FAA, right? And these rules, every single airline has to obey them, right? So they are strict rules. There's no way to violate them. And some of them are actually very, very complicated. One of the most complicated rules is the so-called 1824 rule, which is imposed by the FAA in the US. And that rule is quite complex. It's complex even to explain in words, but it's even more complex than to put it on the computer. All right? So these are one set of rules. Another set of rules are actually contractual rules, which are the rules between the union and the actual airline. So those rules, for example, they impose quite a massive structure on the cost structure, on the cost of a pairing. So a cost of a pairing, so whichever crew is going to fly that pairing, it's actually not that simple. A cost of a pairing in the U.S., it's the maximum of three quantities. And it doesn't matter really, for the time being, it doesn't matter what are those three quantities. Right? But these are type of rules that come from here. And they may, you know, and the union rules, for example, specify as well that you can be away from home at most 3 days, for example, or 4 days. Right? So these are the rules that are not imposed by FAA, by the FAA, but usually they are spelled out clearly in the union's contract. All right. So then, with all this input, there is crew pairing optimization, which finds crew itineraries. And then those crew itineraries or pairings are here. So generic. So the crew pairing optimization, the output is a set of generic crew itineraries, right? And I'm going to focus now on this yellow box or circle over here. So this is going to be the focus is going to be on the crew pairing optimization, and the stress will be on optimization, right? So from now on, we'll kind of focus on optimization. Let me first formally define what is the crew pairing problem. And here, I will kind of give you the academic model, and I just briefly touch upon, you know, how do you make it practical, right? So we have a set of flights of a fleet, and the objective is we want to find a set of crew itineraries that partition all of the flights. A flight is the same as a leg, right? So in the airline industry, sort of leg is a more common term. So you want to partition all legs, and you want to partition the flights with pairings in such a way that the airline incurs the least cost, right? So basically, if you start with 400 flights, you want to partition those flights, which pretty much means that every single flight must be assigned to one crew pairing. Right, because you know one crew will have to fly that flight, right? So that's what it says. The requirement says you got to have one crew flying a particular flight, right? And this is for example one possible crew pairing. Suppose that the crew starts in Atlanta at whatever time, 8 in the morning, right? So an arrow now shows a flight. And this is time clearly. So a crew in this particular crew pairing. The crew starts in Atlanta at 8 in the morning. It flies to Jacksonville. It lands in Jacksonville at whatever, say 9:30. Then it waits in Jacksonville for whatever, say 45 minutes. It takes a flight to Miami, then from Miami to Jacksonville. And this is what it's called one duty because the crew only has short connections here. Right? So the crew doesn't really go into a hotel and overnight and takes a rest here. Right, so that's why it's called a duty. Then at 5 p.m., the crew comes to Jacksonville. Now it has so-called layover or rest. Right, so it goes to a hotel. It takes a nice sleep. And then at 10 in the morning, next day, right, so this you see, this is Monday, 10 in the morning on Tuesday, then the crew goes from Jacksonville to Miami and then from Miami back home to Atlanta. So here I'm assuming that this crew is actually stationed in Atlanta. Right? So this is a possible pairing, right? And what you have to find is you have to partition your flights in the set of this kind of pairings. Now, one thing that I'll come back a little bit later is you can see that you can model this in a network, right? If you create, or if you say visualize a node here. For every departure and every arrival, you can visualize conceptually a node, right? And then you make an arc between two nodes if there is a corresponding flight between those two nodes. In addition, you throw in arcs that represent possible crew connections, right? So whenever an arrival node of a flight connects to a departure node of a flight, it means that the crew can, you know, can connect there. It's a feasible crew connection. Right? So you can now think about, you know, as this pairing being simply paths in the underlying network. Right? So this we'll use this a little bit later, this concept of networks and crew pairings being paths in a network. Right. So what is the underlying crew pairing model? And this is the academic model. So the objective is to minimize the crew cost. So we'll read what is here as well as we'll follow the model here. So first of all, XP is for every pairing, we have a variable, XP. And the variable XP is 1 if we select that particular pairing or 0 otherwise. Right? So this is a typical way to model a generic set partitioning problem. So if you open any textbook and you go into the index and find set partitioning, and you go back into the book and find, you know, the underlying model, you'll see variables XP is 1 if we select a subset and 0 otherwise. So this is the same. This is identical here. Every pairing has a cost CP. So we want to minimize the total cost. So we want to minimize summation CPXP. That's easy. The only other constraint is, as I said, we need to partition. So we need to assign every single leg to one and only one pairing. And that's what this constraint here says. For every leg I, pick a leg I, and this says you must pick exactly one pairing that covers I. So this means that leg I is in pairing P. That's how this should be read. Right? And this is the underlying model. Now, in reality, in practice, there are other constraints. You have the so-called manpower constraints. Those can be modeled, all right? So you write here a bunch of other constraints. You know, it's a fairly simple exercise to impose all of the practical constraints on top of this model here, right? So, you know, before I was kind of a little bit criticizing the academic model, but the underlying solution methodology and so forth works in a practical setting as well, where you start with this model and you simply add a few more constraints. All right, so now for simplicity now, you know, those constraints will be left out. We'll just simply focus on this model over here. All right, so let me just briefly tell you, I don't have many slides here, just briefly tell you what were the two kind of dominant solution methodologies in the past, say, 20 years. All right, so it's all kind of started, so first of all, let me first tell you a little bit why is this problem here very, very difficult. So this model, solving this model here, it is very, very difficult. And I will tell you why. All right. First of all, you have very complex rules. All right. So when when do you have a column in that matrix or in that model there, it's very difficult to detect. All right. So this is a column that represents a pairing. This is a column that does not represent the pairing, and therefore it's not present in the model. All right, so that's actually very difficult because you have all sorts of this, let's say, weird, complex rules like the 1824 rule. All right, again, it doesn't really matter what that rule is. Just believe me, it's very hard to capture this rule on a computer. Then you have all sorts of other rules. The maximum block time. Block time is the flying time. All right, so in a pairing, typically, you can have at most a certain number of flying hours. And it's even more, not just in a pairing, it's even more. In every single duty, the number of flying hours must not be more than, I can tell you the number, sort of 500 minutes. All right, whatever, well, how many hours is that? 8 hours, roughly, right? So in every single duty, you cannot fly more than 8 hours, right? So these are this type of rules, and you have many of such rules. Right, so I'm very familiar with the underlying software packages, and I can tell you, you can easily end up with like 20 such rules, that you need to incorporate when you generate pairing. All right, so then the union rules also pose a problem, because in the U.S., by union contract, a pairing typically, the cost of a pairing is typically the maximum of three quantities. One is the actual flying that you do, right? So you definitely don't want to be paid less than the actual flying. Second is you don't want to be paid, you know, if you stay away from home for 4 days and you fly only, say, every day one flight, you know, if you're just paid based on flying, you would not be happy, right? I mean, because it was not your choice that you had to stay away for 4 days with so little flying, right? So the second component is if you stay away from whatever number of days, you get paid at least a certain amount. The third component is similar, and it says if you are, you know, so this was number of days that you stay away. The third component typically is you get paid at least a fixed amount of dollars per day, per working day, right? So that's the third component. So this creates, you know, a problem, because CP in this model here is the maximum of three quantities, right? So you cannot just put, if we go back to the network representation, you cannot just put one number to any R and say, all right, the cost of my path or pairing is just simply the sum of those numbers. You cannot do it because it is the maximum of three quantities. And the last obstacle is the sheer size of the problem. The number of pairings, even for a small to medium-sized problem, the number of pairings, which corresponds to the number of columns in your model, we are easily talking about 10 million columns for smaller to medium-sized problem. For a large-scale problem, the number of columns can simply be, you know, millions and millions and millions of columns that you have to deal with, right? So that's the third obstacle. So now, let me just very briefly introduce you with two solution methodologies that were kind of, today are kind of deemed obsolete. The first one is the so-called TRIP approach, and it was developed in early 90s at American Airlines. It was at that time, so in early 90s, it was considered being a major breakthrough, because it actually was finding, you know, with at that time computing power, it was actually finding relatively good solutions. And the idea behind TRIP is very simple. So this is a set of flights that you need to partition. So what you do is you have an underlying solution already, right? So you have an underlying partition. You pick, say, I don't know, let's say we have a solution with five pairings, and you pick, say, three pairings, right? So a subset of pairings. You pick three pairings, and you take the underlying flights associated with those three pairings. Here I'm depicting them in red, all right? And what you do simply is you take this red flight, and you try to find better pairings on this red flight over here. If you manage to do it, all right, you simply discard the old three pairings, and you replace them with your new pairing. And clearly you improve the solution, right? And then you simply loop this. Okay, so this, you know, so you optimize over this red flight, right? And you end up with a new schedule. Then you pick a different, say, three or four pairings, okay, or two pairings. It doesn't really matter. All right? Is that again depicted in red? You solve the problem only over this red flight. If you find a better solution, fine. You discard the previous one and you stick in the new one, right? And you keep repeating this. Another approach was a so-called sprint approach, where Alice Johnson was, for example, involved with it. What this does is it a priori generates several million pairings, say, I don't know, 2 million pairings, and it then tries to solve the problem over those 2 million pairings, all right? And it solves the problem in the following way. First, the linear programming realization is solved over those 2 million columns, all right? And that's by the so-called sprint approach, okay, which pretty much means that you add batches of pairings at once. Okay? It doesn't really matter. I don't want to go into details here what is the sprint approach. So you solve the LP relaxation, and then based on the reduced cost of the LP, you select 10,000 pairings. Okay, so this is a very fairly small chunk out of the 2 million pairings that you have, right? So you select 10,000 pairings, and then you solve the IP over these 10,000 pairings. So that's the idea, right? Now, keep in mind that you select 2 million pairings a priori out of millions and millions of pairings that you have at your disposal, right? So that's the limitation of this methodology over here. So again, you know, what are the drawbacks of these two methodologies, so the sprint and the trip approach? Well, it has only a limited view, right? So trip considers only a small subset of legs per iteration, and sprint, it starts only with a small subset of pairings. Now, local view, right, what country is this? Well, you know, it's Canada, right? What country is this? US, that was easy, right? So this is local view, right? That's a little bit more tricky. What country is this? Well, you know, right? It's Mexico, right? Okay, I have to disguise it here. All right, what country is this? You know, that's easy. Which one is it? All right, what country is this? Uh-huh, what is it? What country is it, Barry? Mongolia. Ah, you all failed the test. This is the most beautiful country in the world. It's called Slovenia. All right. This is the country that I'm from. All right. This is a small, tiny country in Europe. All right. But anyway, so the bottom line here is this is local view. Right. So all these two approaches, they are based on local view. So you kind of look at individual countries and you try to, you know, optimize, let's say, in every single individual country. Right. What is needed now in order to get better solutions? Right. Well, I can tell you. Okay. So this is Austria, a little bit, you know, geography. This is Austria. This is Italy. I was born right here, very, very close to the Italian border. All right. So in order, if you want to get better solutions, what you need is you need more global view, right? So you need to consider the entire world at once and not, you know, small countries or small pieces of the entire map, right? So this is what is needed. And this is where advances in the last 5 years have been done, right? So from going from the local view to more on the global view. All right, so let me briefly talk about the underlying algorithms that are, you know, underneath this, let's say, global view paradigm. There are two main algorithms. And this is, you know, this is what you see in the literature, in the academic literature, as well what is behind vendors, okay, what crew pairing vendors actually use. So on the one hand, you have the so-called branch and price methodologies. So that, I don't know if you're familiar with branch and price or not, but I have one slide later, okay, but I'm not going to go really into details of what is branch and price. The other methodology which hopefully, you know, most of you are familiar with the so-called Lagrangian relaxation-based approach. And I do have a slide on Lagrangian relaxation later as well. All right? Now, a common, say, theme to both of these approaches is that there's simply no way to consider all the pairings at once. Right? So what you do is you generate a subset of pairings, right? But you don't stop, okay? Because sprint, you know, in sprint you generate subset of pairings and you stick with those pairings. In here, in both of these two solution methodologies, you generate a subset of pairings, you do something with them, you generate a new subset of pairings, all right? You combine them together, you do something, you generate a third subset of pairings, and so forth. So you keep iterating, so you dynamically generate pairings, all right? As kind of as need be, that's what I mean here, as need be. Whenever you need a new pairing and you have an opportunity to improve your solution, well, go get it, all right? So you kind of generate on the fly a new pairing, all right? So this is something, you know, this is still kind of, this is a slide on the kind of soft side, all right? What is really needed if you really want to implement a crew pairing solver in case sort of one day you want to start up your own company and you want to compete with these big guys like Sabre, for example, all right? There are many challenges. You know, if you want to go from academia to industry, so there are many challenges. And I can tell you this firsthand experience because I've actually implemented a crew solver, which is, you know, it's used by my students, so I'm not telling it, okay? But I can tell you that if you want to come up with something that can be used for several airlines, okay, which in other words means for several clients, it's actually not that easy. And The reason is most in these rules, because you have, you know, every airline has its own rules. If you go to the U.S., these are the rules. If you go to the, even within the U.S., okay, if you go to American Airlines, you'll get a set of rules. If you go to United, you'll get a set of, you know, completely different rules. Some of them will overlap, okay, but most of them will be completely different. If you go to a European carrier, it's going to be again different, right? So it's very easy, it's very difficult to come up with a with robust software. So in other words, with software that is, you know, kind of easy customizable. And second, you want to have a computationally efficient solver. And that's probably, you know, even harder than the first point that was made here. All right. So now one slide on Benchmark Price and two slides on Benchmark Price and one slide on Lagrangian. Benchmark Price, what is it? I assume that you know what is branch and bound in integer programming. If you don't, then, you know, I could talk here for half an hour about integer programming, but I'm not going to do that. About branch and bound, sorry. So branch and price is branch and bound where LP relaxations are solved by delayed column generation or by column generation. Column generation we'll see a little bit later, okay? So I'll tell you what column generation is a little bit later. But the bottom line here is that it is branch and bound where at every node, when you need to solve the LP relaxation, you use a specialized algorithm. All right, that's what is behind branch and price. All right, now in this group pairing branch and price methodologies, what is in this when you solve these LPs? What is behind that is challenging is how do you generate pairings? All right, so you start with 10,000 pairings. You want to generate 10 new pairings. How do you do that? That's a major obstacle. All right. I'm not sure how much you are into branch and price, so I guess I'm going to skip that slide. All right. Now, let me talk a little bit about Lagrangian relaxation. And here again, you know, if you've never seen Lagrangian relaxation, you're not going to understand it from this slide. What you do in Lagrangian relaxation algorithm is you relax all the constraints. You put a penalty in the traditional, you know, Lagrangian sense, and you throw everything into the objective function. So you end up with, what you end up with is this problem over here. You want to, for fixed lambda, you are finding the best axis, right, based on this cost function over here. And then this provides you, so for every fixed lambda, this expression here, it provides you a lower bound on your optimal cost, right? So what you do is you want to come up with the best possible lower bound, which means you want to find a lambda that actually maximizes this expression over here. So that's standard, you know, Lagrangian relaxation. And now, in terms of the embedded in a group pairing solver, the way it's done is you consider a small subset of pairings, say, I don't know, 20,000 pairings, and you solve the Lagrangian relaxation problem. So at the end, you come up with a set of multipliers. All right, so these are just lambdas. And you use these lambdas as pretty much kind of dual prices in your LP. All right, so based on those lambdas, you then generate new pairings. Generate new pairings, you resolve this Lagrangian relaxation problem. You come up with new lambdas, generate new pairings, and so forth. So you iterate in this way, in this fashion. All right? The way you solve this Lagrangian relaxation, it's typically solved by the so-called subgradient algorithm. It can be also a bundle method. Right, it doesn't really matter. For the overall, you know, algorithm, it doesn't really matter. So now we come to the most kind of involved part, which is let's focus on branch and price, and let's see how would one solve the underlying linear programming relaxation at every node. Right? So we are currently, you know, forget about that we are at a node, because it doesn't really matter. I mean, there is no kind of difference. Let's just solve the root node LP relaxation. Right? And this is for the classical column generation scheme. All right, so the classical, you know, column generation algorithm that was discovered 1960, I think, by Gomery, or roughly around that time. All right, so the idea here is the following. We need to solve an LP over millions of columns, okay, an LP that has millions of columns. Clearly, you don't want to consider all the columns at once. So what you do is you have a small subset S of columns. You solve the LP relaxation over those columns, and you get the corresponding pi. Pi is a dual vector. So pi is a dual vector. First of all, you know, if you're lucky and pi is actually dual feasible for all the columns, you're optimal, all right? You're lucky and you're optimal. Most of the times, it's not going to be. So what you do is you select a subset of low reduced cost columns with respect to pi, right? I hope you know what is reduced cost. So the reduced cost is pretty much dual slack, right? If you write a dual and you look at the slack of a constraint, that's what the reduced cost is, right? So you find a subset f bar of low reduced cost columns pi with respect to pi, sorry, and you add the subset s bar to your previous set s. Okay, so this LP here kind of grows and grows, and if it becomes too big, you simply chop it off, right? So these are technical engineering details. So this is classical column generation. Now, the problem with this column generation procedure, at least when it's applied to the crude pairing optimization, it works. So this column generation works for many, many problems. For crude pairing, it doesn't work that nicely. And the reason is degeneracy. You have very, very heavy tailing effect. All right, so you don't, you know, you get within, say, I don't know, 5% from the optimal solution, and then you just simply cannot close the gap. You know, you just keep going and going and going. And the reason is degeneracy of the underlying LP. So the crude pairing LPs are very, very degenerate, right? And there are two ways to cope with that or to improve this. And this is recent stuff. So this is last 5 years, for example. One methodology, the so-called primal dual algorithm. The idea here is that you have your primal solution at every iteration. Okay, so here we only deal with the primal solution here and the pi that was just a dual feasible solution, but only over a subset of columns. The main idea here is that you have a dual feasible solution pi. It's always going to be denoted pi on this slide, all right? And pi, it is a dual feasible solution, so it's dual feasible throughout all of the columns that you have. If you have 100 million columns, for all 100 million columns, pi is feasible, all right? And at the same time, you also have an X, which is a kind of a primal feasible solution, all right? And now you try to improve both of them, all right? So the pi moves from below up, right, because the dual is you're maximizing, right, and the primal is you're minimizing. And when you close the gap to, you know, let's say zero, then you stop, right? So let me give you a schematical view of the primal dual algorithm, the way it works for crude pairing. Okay, so that's different than you see here, dancing forward and Farquharson for matching and network flows and so forth. This algorithm is the underlying idea is similar, but the algorithm is actually different. So what you do is the following. You still have a small LP, all right? So let's say 10,000 columns, all right? So this S corresponds, it has 10,000 columns, all right, out of millions of columns that you have. You solve the LP. You find the dual solution rho, all right? So now your original LP has many, many more columns, right? And this rho will violate some of these columns. Some of the reduced cost, right? Some of the reduced cost with respect to this rho will be negative. Actually, if all of the columns are non-negative, then rho is actually dual optimal and you stop the algorithm, right? These are minor details, okay? So rho violates some of the columns that are over there, all right? So now what you do is you take the convex combination of rho and your dual feasible vector pi, all right? So this is, you know, for any alpha between 0 and 1, this here is simply a convex combination between rho and pi, right? And now what you do is you want to find an alpha that gives you the best possible improvement with respect to the dual objective value, right? So you want to find an alpha such that C times this expression here, B is the right hand side, such that B times this expression here is as large as possible, all right? So you find, sorry. Pi here, on the left here, you mean? All right, I'm about to come to this. This box over here? Yeah, so you find the best possible alpha, all right? And then you set the pi for the next iteration, then becomes this linear combination here. This is the, let's say, computer science writing, you know, or in other words, code. You know, I is I plus one. Right? So the new pi becomes the linear combination, the convex combination of the old pi and the vector rho. Right? Now you get your new pi. Now what you do with respect to this new pi, you find, you select a different subset S of pairings or columns, and this subset that you find is a set of, with respect to the low reduced cost, with respect to this new pi. Right? So you find this new subset S, you resolve the LP, new row, and you simply loop. Right? So as you can see here, the difference between this and this algorithm over here is that here, at every single iteration, we always have a dual feasible vector. This algorithm here, this pi here, it's not a dual feasible vector. This pi is feasible. This is actually kind of sloppy notation. This should be better be called rho. All right. So this pi here, it's not dual feasible. But this one over here, it's always dual feasible. All right. Now, all right. So this here you have, you know, in words, the algorithm. But I think this figure here conveys more than what is here in the slide. So you can read it later if you want to. All right. So the, you know, graphically, the idea behind the algorithm is here we have our dual feasible pi. So this is a dual feasibility set, right? So this is a dual feasible set. We have our old pi, right? We have our rho, which is outside of the dual feasible set, right? If rho is inside, then the algorithm is actually optimal. I mean, then you stop the algorithm because you found the optimal solution, right? So this rho is somewhere outside. You take a straight line between pi and rho, and you go along this line as far as you can in such a way that you stay within the dual feasibility set, right? You don't want to cross this boundary because then pi, it's not going to be dual feasible in the next iteration, right? So as soon as you hit this boundary here, you stop. I mean, it's not you stop. Okay, so that's your new pi then, right? And you iterate now. You keep going. You loop over this over and over again. All right. Now, how do you, I'm supposed to be technical, right? So now it becomes even more technical. So how do you find this alpha, right? So in this step here, you need to find an alpha such that this vector here is a dual feasible vector, right? So let's see how we can find this alpha. So dual feasibility simply says, this is, so AI represents a column in the problem, right? So a column in the set partitioning model. Right, so this is AI. So AI, so dual feasibility says AI times the vector must be less or equal to CI. CI is the ith component of your cost vector. Right, so this is dual feasibility. Nothing more fancy. Right, very straightforward. Now you can easily rewrite this as alpha times AI rho minus AI pi less or equal to CI minus AI pi. Right, now pi is a dual feasible vector. All right? So what is the sign of this quantity over here? It's a dual feasible vector, so that means that the reduced cost of a dual feasible vector is always greater or equal to zero. Right? So this quantity here, it's always greater or equal to zero. Right? And if you write a computer code, if that's not the case, hey, you have a bug in the code. All right? So this is always greater or equal to zero. So now, we want to find alpha as large as possible. Well, it means that if this expression here is negative, any alpha will do it, right? We want to find an alpha between 0 and 1, right? So I can pick any alpha. If this here is negative, I can pick any alpha, and I will have this inequality here. So what you want is, you want to consider only this expressions here that are positive, right? So for those that are positive, you can actually divide by this positive number, right? And you get that alpha needs to be less or equal to this quantity over here. And now, since you want to improve your dual objective function as much as possible, that's equivalent to saying that you want to make alpha as large as possible, right? So that means that alpha is simply the minimum over all columns of this side over this guy over here for all those that are strictly positive, all right? So those, again, those that are negative here, those columns that have this expression here negative, we don't need to consider them because for any alpha will do the job for them, right? So this is how one finds this alpha, right? So you see that you can actually come up with an explicit representation. Now let's go even further to something that is even more recent, the so-called steepest edge algorithm. So if you go look back into linear programming literature, the steepest edge dual simplex was introduced, I think, in 1970s, so well, 30 years ago, roughly, okay? But it was actually never used in a column generation framework. So this is, I should say, all right, so Ellis Johnson and a student and Earl Barnes came up with this algorithm about 2 years ago, approximately. All right. So this is so-called steepest edge algorithm. The idea here is slightly different. It's still going to maintain, this algorithm still maintains a dual feasible solution in every iteration. So there's still this pi, right? But now, you kind of quote, for the time being, let's fix the direction rho, right? This is not the same. It turns out that this rho will not be the same as this guy over here, all right? We'll compute it in a different way. All right. So we are going to move, so we have a current point pi. We are going to move in a direction of rho, right? And we want to move in such a way that we improve the objective function, the dual objective function, as much as possible. Same calculations as before. You can easily come up with an explicit expression for alpha, right? This is one over here, right? So the main question now is, how do we select this direction rho, right? So this expression here holds for any rho. Now, how do we find this rho? Well, we observe the following. Let's define a set of columns E such that the reduced cost is zero, right? So this expression here says reduced cost is zero, right? Now, consider now the linear program that has only columns corresponding to this set E, right? So you have a dual feasible vector. You select only columns with zero reduced cost, right? Typically, I don't know, say 20,000 columns that have zero reduced cost. And now you consider only the LP over those 20,000 columns, right? You have two cases for this LP here. X here is no negative, right? You have two choices. First one is that this LP here is feasible. In this case, you're actually very lucky because it means that you're optimal. And the reason is complementarity slackness, right? Outside of E, the corresponding X is zero, so you have complementarity slackness. Inside of E, you have complementarity slackness because you selected the columns with respect with zero reduced cost, right? So it's very, you know, if you sit down in a minute, sort of, you can figure out that if this problem here is feasible by complementarity slackness, it's actually, you have an optimal X and pi, right? So this X then is optimal and pi is optimal as well. Now, suppose this LP now is infeasible. That means that you're still not optimal. Alright? Now, you use Farkas lemma. By Farkas lemma, so just simply take this LP here, write the Farkas lemma. By Farkas lemma, there exists a rho such that rho E less equal to zero, rho B strictly greater than zero. So you find such a rho. Right? And this still doesn't give you the best possible direction. Okay? But for any such rho, which by Farkas exists, okay, you have at least one, this is clearly an improving direction because B, the dual objective is B times the dual vector, right? So B times the new dual vector, pi plus T rho, is strictly greater than B times pi. That's because B times rho is strictly greater to zero, right? Now, there are technical details here, right? Because you can say, hey, T can be zero, right? Let's assume that T is not zero, right? Those are technical details, okay? So T is strictly greater than zero. Then clearly this here holds from this property over here. So that means that your new vector, this one over here, is going to have a better objective value. Right? So this is what this expression here says. Right? So now, it's still, you know, I still didn't quite specify which row to take. Now we know that we have at least one row where we can improve the dual value, but there can be many rows with this property here. Right? So now it turns out that if you want to pick the best one, which is the kind of the steepest ascent, you need to solve this nonlinear problem here. So this is the Euclidean norm. So you take this, you know, you kind of, you know, this problem here, all right, this problem here is infeasible. So you know that you cannot, if you look at AE XE minus B, and you look at the norm of that vector, you know that that norm, it's not going to be zero, right? Because the problem is infeasible, right? So what you do is you find the vector that actually minimizes this, you know, slack, say, right? Or it minimizes the infeasibility pretty much. And then you take this optimal X and you compute then this vector here. And this gives you actually the best possible direction, right? So this row here gives you the best possible direction. All right. Does it work? Yeah, it gives actually both of these two algorithms, they give much, much better convergence results. Right? So it converges everything much quicker. And this is, you know, firsthand experience, as well as some of the vendors actually use the primal dual algorithm. All right. There have been attempts in the past to actually parallelize these two algorithms, or at least the first one, the primal dual algorithm. And it's actually quite tricky. Now, it's a little bit more tricky to put them in a column generation content, right? Because you have this kind of rational expressions there. All right, how much time do I have?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. All right. Pricing, it's very interesting. You want to see some? You see some figures. Anyway, here's a very good riddle. All right. What does this riddle say? I don't know. All right, what is this lady here? She is constrained, right? What are these? Shorts, right? So constrained, shortest path, right? All right, so the title of this slide is Constrained Shortest Path. All right, so see, Constrained Shortest Path. There is an algorithm for pricing that's called Constrained Shortest Path. I have nice figures. One more nice figure. All right, there are other ways to do the pricing. So pricing is essentially you have a dual vector. How do you find pairings with the lowest possible reduced cost? And you see that you need this step in all three of the algorithms that are presented. I mean, the vanilla column generation, as well as in the primal dual, as well as the steepest edge. Okay, so that's what pricing is. All right, just a few slides on perspectives on crew pairings. First of all, with this, you know, recent advances, algorithmic as well as in hardware and software, we are now able to pretty much solve to optimality any small to medium-sized problem, right? Problem or fleet, now it's the same, right? Now, if you go to larger fleets, well, we can't quite claim that the solutions that we find are optimal, but we can claim that typically we can find solutions within 1% from the optimality gap, which is actually very good. Right, so 1%, you know, that's very good for large problems. And some of this, you know, advances, yeah, you can contribute to hardware and software. You know, hardware is getting faster and faster. Software, which means compilers, are getting better and better, right? But there have also been advances from the algorithmic perspective, right? So that's what I showed you. I showed you two very recent algorithms that work much better than the previous known algorithm. Now, what is ahead of us? Well, even though you see here, all right, so, you know, we can pretty much solve any problem, right? That's what this slide, you can read in that way. Well, not quite, right? You have now this new models that have emerged in the past 4 to 5 years, right? And on the one hand, there are models that integrate several different models. You remember the second slide that I have after the title, where the business processes? So now, you know, they're like, you take three or four of those processes and you write them as one single model. Those usually require solving crew pairing problems over several subfleets, right? It's not, you know, don't get this wrong. It doesn't mean that, you know, a pilot will fly Airbus 320 as well as Boeing 737. No, that's, you know, when you combine flights from two different subfleets, That's part of the bigger picture, right? At the end, you know, you get what you want, okay? But the point is that larger and larger crew pairing problems need to be solved from this, you know, in order to be able to solve this integrated model. And on the other hand, the second kind of trend line is towards more robust models. Not just minimize the cost, it doesn't help you much if you minimize the cost. If your solution then, you know, with a very tiny thunderstorm hitting an airport, it's completely, you know, out of whack. All right. Thank you very much for your attention.